In the matter of State versus Carter, can we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Mr. Mason, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you. Your Honors, Mr. Carter's conviction stems from an unlawful stop unsupported by reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing. In this case, Detective Johnson testified, and the trial court found that multiple police officers pulled up to Mr. Carter in an SUV, that they got out and approached him with their badges displayed, that they identified themselves as police, and that Detective Johnson told Mr. Carter to stop, which he did, all without reasonable suspicion. Nonetheless, the trial and appellate courts found that no stop occurred and that Mr. Carter's constitutional rights were not violated. In doing so, the courts overlooked key principles underlying the protection against unreasonable searches and seizures, as well as this court's precedents in interpreting that right, including State versus Crawley and State versus Tucker. Those cases, along with common notions of reasonableness, show that a reasonable person in Mr. Carter's position would not have felt free to leave and ignore the police officers, and that he was instead stopped, and that that stop was illegal because it is undisputed that it was not supported by reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing. Accordingly, this court should reaffirm its prior holdings, suppress the evidence, which was derived from the unlawful stop, and reverse Mr. Carter's conviction.
Why isn't it a field inquiry?
The main inquiry, or the main question that we're looking at, whether it's a field inquiry, is really whether a reasonable person would feel free to ignore the police and go on his way.
But
and
he
the
did, normal, didn't he? I mean, they said stop, and he backed away and started to walk away, saying, "I thought you wanted me to leave." And then he threw the drugs out on the floor in front of him. I don't see what the issue is here.
The testimony, Your Honor, was that Mr. Carter was walking away when the police were still about 100 feet away. Then they pulled about 25 feet away, got out of the car, and then told him to stop. And at that point, Mr. Carter stopped. He turned around and spoke to the police officers. So while we're looking objectively, Mr. Carter did in fact stop, which I think is relevant at least to the detention issue under the Fourth Amendment. But when you have all of these other circumstances going on, this brings us far beyond what a field inquiry would be, which is the police coming up and asking somebody if they're willing to answer some questions.
Why is this different from Witt in terms of the waiver issue?
This is different than Witt, Your Honor, because Witt was really focused on whether there was an opportunity for the parties to develop a record and whether there was enough information in the record to resolve the case. And in this case, unlike in Witt, we have all that. The parties not only had an opportunity to develop the record, but they actually did so. There was extensive questioning regarding the detention, both on direct and cross-examination, including about why the officers approached, how they approached, what Mr. Carter did in response. They spent more time on that than on the inventory search. The trial court also made factual and legal findings regarding the stop, and the state indicated that they developed the record that they wanted, invited a challenge to it, actually discussed whether this was a legal approach or not on page 5 of the trial brief, and then declined to even argue waiver in the appellate division.
How and when did you first challenge the stop? Not the search, but the stop.
On appeal or in the trial?
At the outset of the case, at the trial court.
So the actual challenge and argument regarding the stop for the first time was raised before the appellate division. This was still an issue, I think, that was recognized by the court and the parties in the trial court, but there wasn't an explicit argument until the appellate division.
So isn't that a bit of a problem for us? I mean, you mentioned there was testimony. I count no fewer than 3 versions of what the officers said or didn't say at the outset. And because this appears to have been a challenge to the search at the trial court level and not the stop, we didn't have the focus that would be helpful in that regard.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think that there still was a focus on this issue, both because it's a necessary step to get to the valid inventory stop or inventory search, and because it was an issue that was raised by the prosecutor and by defense counsel. Defense counsel should have explicitly challenged it, But this is something that was clearly on the mind of the parties and the trial court.
How about the brief? I'm looking at the trial court. I'm looking at page AA13. The detective testified the defendant was not doing anything suspicious and there was no probable cause to stop him. That's coming from your brief. I'm using the collective your.
Sorry, at AA13?
Yeah. April 19th, 2016. And apparently it was agreed that briefs were not going to be filed before the motion to suppress, but afterwards. Look at the statement of facts.
Yes.
Bottom line.
Bottom line, yes. They said
So the defense attorney made an assertion before the trial court ruled, correct?
Yes.
There was direct examination and cross-examination directly on the stop.
Yes, Your Honor. This was something that,
Okay. So the other question I want to ask you about procedures generally.
Yes.
Under Rule 357, when there is a warrantless search, this was a warrantless search, there is supposed to be a brief and a statement of facts filed by the state.
Yes.
Was that done in this case?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So that wasn't complied with. If that was complied with, you were supposed to do a counter statement of facts, correct?
Yes.
So was there an agreement between the plaintiff and defendant that you would be filing, that they were going to be filing post-hearing briefs? And that's the reason why this brief came after the testimony?
I don't know if there was an agreement between the parties beforehand, but in this case there was.
Do you know why the state did not file its initial brief and statement of facts?
No, Your Honor. I would agree that the rule required it, but I don't know why that wasn't complied with.
Wouldn't it be? I'm sorry.
No, but the reason for that rule is so that everyone knows what's being contested.
Right.
So there was noncompliance with that.
Yes. Yeah, and it was the state's burden to justify it. And at this point, I think it is significant that wasn't complied with, and I think it's also significant that the briefing didn't happen until after, because it shows that it didn't actually limit the scope of what the testimony that was being.
That can't have come out of nowhere. If the court was expecting the briefs in the normal course, they got to the hearing with no briefs. The court would have said right at the outset, "I think, guys, we're missing something here. So you haven't filed briefs." So there must have been some discussion we're not aware of.
There's nothing in the record, and I'm not aware of anything outside of it. This wasn't originally handled by our office, so I don't know what the conversation was at that point.
The notice also, probably not a model to be filed, but seems to be broad enough to have encompassed both the stop and the search, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Wouldn't it be helpful if the notice of motion said, "I seek to suppress the evidence, defendant seeks to suppress the evidence, challenging the stop and challenging the search, so that we know what's at stake before the testimony begins."
That would have been better, Your Honor. But I wouldn't have, I think it was, while not perfectly phrased, was broadly phrased, and not only, I think, what
procedures utilized and searches conducted. So procedures utilized is a reference of some sorts to the stop.
I think it could be read that way. I think the parties at least read it that way based on the fact that the testimony itself wasn't actually limited to just the inventory search and that the state invited a challenge to it afterward.
So one would expect, if it had been crystal clear at the outset that the stop was being challenged as well as the search, that we would have had more direct or cross to focus in on the words that were said to clarify that, correct?
I'm not sure that I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Would we want to know the tone?
I think that there are additional information, there is additional information that could have been elicited and maybe ideally would have been there.
Would we want to know where the other officers were located in order to make an assessment as to the nature of the stop?
I think those are questions that could have been asked, but if we're looking at what the actual record was that was developed that I think the parties agreed was sufficient to actually challenge it, then we have enough information to determine that there was a stop
this,
here.
This issue does not appear to have been an issue for the state. At the motion to suppress, no one was raising any question about that. No, the state wasn't raising it before the appellate division. It was raised by the appellate division on its own, and then the state started running with it.
Yes,
the state had no problem with the development of the record all the way through the appellate division.
Yes,
it's only since they've come to the Supreme Court that they're arguing that, you know, the record isn't developed enough.
But wasn't that, in fact, an issue at the end of the suppression hearing? Wasn't it, in fact, an issue as to whether the stop itself had been questioned and whether that was going to be an issue? And wasn't there even a discussion between counsel and the court about if that was going to be raised, we might raise that also? Didn't say I raised it. Didn't say I examined it. I said I might raise that also. That'll be the subject of post-hearing briefs. Isn't that what the conversation was?
The conversation, it was on pages 29 to 30 of the transcript, it's after the suppression hearing, which is significant because of
in
that.
I'm sorry,
Your Honor.
No, I have the quote here.
The prosecutor at the point says, you can obviously argue if you think they didn't have a right even to go up to him. At that point, defense counsel says, I'll touch on that in my brief. Ultimately, he does not explicitly touch on this.
And isn't
brief.
That an implication that that's not the issue they were having the hearing on?
I think it would be more significant if that were beforehand and actually influenced the testimony
really?
That was elicited. Because if we're looking at whether the record was developed, which is what Witt talks about, this is after it. This is after all the testimony.
Why would they be asking that question if it was developed and that was the subject of the hearing?
I think that was a question at the very beginning of the hearing saying what
issues
are...
This is at the end.
Yeah, this is at the end. I'm saying it would be more significant if it were at the beginning and actually changed the course of the testimony that was elicited. Because this is after the state has already...
Oh, I know that. That's my point.
Would you agree that it gives the impression that this was at most an afterthought on the part of the defense attorney and there was nothing flagging for the state that it should focus its proofs at the hearing on that issue?
And defense counsel should have focused on this issue.
No, I'm not being judgmental about defense counsel. I'm just talking about what's this record look like from this perspective of the state that has to meet a burden of proof.
The record from the state, I think, comes directly from the trial prosecutor, which is, this is the record. If you want to argue that there was an unlawful stop, you can do it. And at that point, the officer had finished testifying, the state had rested. So I think that's the strongest indication, which I think is really unusual for a case like this, to say, not only can we objectively see that the record was developed, we know that the state subjectively believed that in the trial court and in the appellate division based on the fact that they didn't.
Let me just ask you about that. Are you relying on the fact that the police officers allegedly said stop? And that in the transcript when the officer first testified, he said, I said to stop. Is that what you're relying on to show that it was not simply an inquiry?
Well, there's all the other aspects of what the officers did before that, but that is part of it. I think
getting
also,
out of the van, being in uniform, all that stuff.
Yeah, but the badges displayed, but that and so that is something that
hanging around their neck.
The officer's testimony was displayed. I think the actual discussion about them hanging around the neck came from the state's brief, but he said that the badges were displayed.
But that was not testified to. Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay.
Yeah, he did testify, Your Honor, about the badges being displayed.
So let me come back to what I was. But you're relying at least in part, and is it significant? How significant is it that the officers purportedly said stop? Does that change the character of the stop?
I think there was enough for there to have been a stop even without it. I think that could have been enough on its own as well.
Help.
But it is relevant, and it's something that the detective. Sorry.
No, I'm interrupting you. I apologize.
I'm happy to defer to you on that.
Was there any specific finding by the trial court that they were told to stop? Because there's testimony initially that we said stop, and the officer says, no, actually, he stopped on his own. He repeats that a few times.
There is the finding, Your Honor. The trial court's findings are on page 9 of the second transcript, where he says that the police identified themselves, asked him to stop, which he did. So the phrasing is a little bit different. It's a little bit different than what it was before. But the finding is that they said stop.
And Mr. Mason, there's three versions, and I know you wanted to get to this before. Page 11 of the transcript informed him to stop or not. Page 13 told him. And then at page 20, he stopped on his own before I could say anything. Let me tell you what's bothering me and invite your response. I think you raise a strong argument as to whether this was a field inquiry or an investigative stop. But the record seems like it could benefit from some fleshing out. Wouldn't a remand at this point be appropriate so that we could get to the merits of the hard question?
I don't think a remand would be appropriate in this case. I don't think any additional information that we would learn on a remand would actually make a difference, first of all, and I think it would also be unfair because the record was actually developed as the state indicated. If they have a different tone, I would submit that that would not make a difference in this case. You still have officers telling him to stop, and I think the state's argument that they would elicit additional testimony about that is contrary to their own position now that he never said stop. If we were to find out that there were officers blocking Mr. Carter's position, then that would only make a stop more likely.
The judge made fact findings here, too.
Yes.
It's true that the officer gave inconsistent statements on direct and on cross, but on page 9, the judge said the defendant walked away and the officers identified themselves as police and asked him to stop, which he did.
Yes.
Tell me if I'm mistaken about one of the differences between this case and in Witt is in Witt, there was no testimony about the stop, and the judge made no findings about the stop. In this case, we have direct and cross on the stop start, and we have a direct finding by the judge.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. And I think
so is the judge's finding supported by the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
The judge says he was asked to stop, but I just read for you the testimony, and there's no testimony that the officer asked the defendant to stop.
I think
this is part of the problem with the record.
I think the court's finding is still that they said stop. I think there is that sort of, he says ask, all the testimony is told, and inform, I think inform is the same thing as told. But I think the court's finding on this is that he did say to stop. And you know, you can say asked, you can say told. At the end of the day, you still have multiple police officers in the situation identifying themselves and telling the person to stop. I think a reasonable person in that situation wouldn't feel free to ignore that. And that there is enough in the record to support all of that. I think Justice Albin's point about how this is different than Witt also applies to how this is different to Robinson. In those cases, this court decided not to address the issue of the high beam statute and Witt because there was no information. It was barren of facts that related to it, and there were no findings. Same thing in Robinson with the flashbang.
It seems to me, I'm looking at the testimony on page 11 by the officer. Did you identify yourselves? This is from the state. This is on direct.
Yes.
Did you identify yourselves at any point as police? Correct. And did you inform him to stop or no? Yes. Did he stop? Yes. I don't see much light between that and the judge's finding that the police asked him to stop, which he did.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the really core issue is whether he said stop or not. And the trial court, with the benefit of having actually observed the testimony, reviewed all the evidence, found that that was actually said.
But did the trial court, when it made those findings, have before it a crystallized issue that we are challenging the stop and you have to make a determination on whether this stop was constitutional? I don't see that. And I think what you have here, and obviously easy for people to hindsight being 20/20, but what you have here is some facts were developed, so, but there was a comment by the state at the end of the hearing that okay, have at it, raise it if you want, then it's not raised in the briefs, which I think you concede, correct?
I think that the issue is not directly raised by the
court. So where was it crystallized for the court that the A core, one of two core issues here, is the legality of the stop, and therefore, judge, your job is to make fact findings that either say it was or say it wasn't?
And the trial court, I would note, not only made factual findings, but also made a legal finding on it. So I think that this isn't something that, you know, the judge just said in passing. This is something that the judge did understand was a potential issue.
Where is it brought to the judge? I mean, it is the obligation of counsel, both sides, to identify for the court what issues are there.
I think it was brought to the court's attention by the fact that the record was developed on the point that the state invited the challenge. Defense counsel indicated he would raise a challenge, although he didn't explicitly later on. And it's also just, like I mentioned before, a necessary step as part of this
overall analysis. Wouldn't that some version of the record as to how all this came about be normally developed, because you're going to end up with a knapsack issue at the police station that everybody agrees had to be decided. So you give the court the chronology of events that led to the search of the knapsack at the police department. I mean, the fact that the stop is mentioned, does that really mean it was presented as an independent constitutional issue?
I think it was presented still in terms of the argument and that the court understood that as such. I think the court understood that there was a different testimony. We asked courts to resolve confusing testimony at any point. And the court made those findings and made an actual, I would submit, wrong, but legal conclusion about whether this was a stop or not.
Where does the court actually say that? Because when I'm looking at the judge's decision at the trial court level, after reciting briefly the facts, the court then turns to the arguments that he feels is being made to him, and the argument is all about the knapsack and whether or not the inventory search is a pretext for a search incident to arrest that was done much later in time. So I'm finding it hard to see that the judge made the kind of findings that you want us to think he was making to support a crystallized constitutional ruling on whether this was a field inquiry versus an investigative stop with sufficient record support to differentiate between the two.
And on page 19, lines 16 to 23 are the relevant findings by the trial court in the second transcript. That's where the trial court finds that the defendant walked away and the officers identified themselves as police and asked him to stop, which he did.
Which transcript, August 4th?
It is the August 29th one, I
believe. Okay, August 29th.
Did you mean page 9?
I think you mean 9, yeah.
August 9th. Oh, yeah, sorry about that.
He's just reciting facts, and then he turns on the next page to, defendant argues because there was no inventory search produced, that no inventory took place, and then talks about the state's concessions, and then makes findings and conclusions about that legal argument, not the one that you're presenting to us today.
I think there are two responses to that, Your Honor. I think, first, the court did, I would submit, make a legal finding saying that a simple stop and inquiry does not appear to violate any of the defendant's rights as he did, in fact, stop and speak to them. So I think that that is an actual legal conclusion. There were factual findings before that. Conceivably, the main issue that the court was focusing on was the inventory search. But this is still something that the court made factual findings on and a legal finding.
Would the question of pretext, which is the core of the knapsack argument, be informed in any way by the prior interaction? In other words, could the court have assumed those facts were presented to me in order to show that there was no pretext by the state and then the argument being in the opposite direction from that? In other words, the court may have thought they were relevant in maybe an attenuated way, but relevant to what it believed its task was.
And I don't know how that would necessarily fit in. There could maybe be some theoretical relevance, but I think the reason why it was presented was to actually show that there was the legal approach, the illegal arrest, at least from the state's point of view, and then ultimately the legal inventory search. But in terms of what the findings are here, I think it would be very difficult, especially in cases going forward, to try to parse these factual findings and make a distinction between these and different factual findings. I mean, to say that, oh, we don't know if the court was focusing on this or whether it was really a crystallized issue on this, I think we would be running into a whole lot of trouble in future cases and saying, well, this factual finding is entitled to normal deference, this one isn't. I don't think that's going to be a workable way to approach it, and I don't think it really makes, I don't think it's really appropriate in this case either.
The state, in this case, and in every case, for a motion to suppress, the state controls the flow of the evidence. In wit, based upon the nature of the filing by the defendant, went right to the search. Here, where the state did not file an initial statement of facts or brief, apparently assumed everything was on the block. And that's the reason why it started out with the search. Was there a stop? Was there suspicious activity? Were you 25 feet away? Were you showing your badge? Were you in uniform? All of that was elicited by the state.
That's right, Your Honor. And I think it is important to kind of pull back a little bit and focus on the fact that that was the record being developed. That's what Witt and Robinson talked about. And I think if we were to go in the opposite direction and say maybe the issue wasn't raised as clearly as it should have been, or the trial court wasn't explicitly asked to resolve this issue, we're going to have to find waiver in every case where it's not explicitly argued. And I would submit that that's contrary to Witt, is contrary to Robinson, is contrary to this court's prior holdings, which have really focused on fairness. As long as the parties have an opportunity to develop the record, as long as the record is not barren of facts needed to resolve the issue, then you can raise these issues.
And you would think that the state would raise the issue of going before the appellate division. The state is arguing the merits. They're not arguing that this was waived. They weren't arguing to the appellate division that there was an undeveloped record.
Yeah, that's
right. Am I mistaken?
They didn't raise it until they filed a response to the ACLU's brief before this court. So that was never an issue before. I think that, along with all of the other actions that the prosecutor took at the trial court, and indicates that they really had the record. I think this is really an anomalous case in terms of waiver. This is sort of the prototypical example of when waiver should not be found.
So I think if we go through this, we can find that this was not handled in the best possible way in a number of respects.
Yes.
To address this going forward, what about a rule that says the notice of motion should state the particular challenge that's being brought? What is the alleged constitutional defect?
I think to have that, I think, would be ideal, but I think we still have to go back to the issue of fundamental fairness, because I think if we're going to turn this all on what the notice actually says, it should say that. I think that parties should be encouraged to do that. I know that we want our office to do that as well. This does not benefit really anyone to have piecemeal litigation or have these issues not directly raised as clearly as they could be. But ultimately, I don't think that can or should determine whether something can be addressed on appeal. I think it still needs to focus on just the issue of fairness, whether we have the record to do it. And I would submit in this case that we really do have that. I think that any reasonable person, based on the facts found by the trial court, testified to by the detective, would not have felt free to leave at that time when he's faced with multiple officers identifying themselves, telling him to stop, and that to adopt either a contrary position on that issue or on the waiver issue, as the state is asking, would really mark a really stark departure from this court's prior precedents, both regarding waiver and the constitutional right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. Unless your honors have any additional questions at this point, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if necessary.
Thank you. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court. My first exposure to appellate criminal practice was when I was in law school and had the privilege of doing some death penalty cases in Alabama. And the most shocking thing that I saw, among many shocking things, was that the philosophy of the Attorney General's office and of the judiciary was to avoid merits adjudication whenever possible, to deem claims procedurally defaulted because the defendant had missed a filing by a day or failed to contemporaneously object to something. And so important winning issues never got into merits adjudication in state or federal court because of this culture of procedural default. And then I came to New Jersey. One of the first cases I came across was Justice Stein's beautiful opinion in Preciosi. And it paints a very, very different picture. Justice Stein talks in glowing terms about the compelling judicial interest in only sustaining those convictions free from constitutional error. The ethos in New Jersey is merits adjudication is valuable. It serves a host of important issues. And Witt did not represent a departure from that general ethos that is embedded in our jurisprudence and in our court rules. Instead, what Witt said is when there's unfair surprise, it's not fair to hold that against the state. When they couldn't possibly have known this was at issue, when the judge didn't reach the issue, we're not going to decide the case on that issue. This is very different. There's only the most strained reading of the record would allow a belief that there was unfair surprise here. And the chronology, I think, is incredibly instructive. Justice Solomon, you seemed surprised by Mr. Mason's answer that when the colloquy happened mattered. I think it's critical, because what happened here is, in contravention of the rules, the state submitted no statement of facts. They then called their witness. They knew they had the burden. They had to make their proofs. They had an evidentiary hearing where they got direct testimony and cross-examination from the witness. In both direct and cross, they focused in part, in greater part than half, on the stop. Then the evidentiary period was closed. So the state assumed it had made all of its necessary proofs. It wasn't going to get another chance to further develop the record. And the prosecutor turned to the defense attorney and said, if you want to argue it wasn't a good stop, go ahead. It wasn't that if you argue that, then I'll call a witness to make it a good stop. So the prosecutor, incorrectly, but the prosecutor thought he had developed a sufficiently robust record.
But aren't we missing something here, Mr. Shalom? Isn't there something that occurred here which is not reflected in these two transcripts? that caused the briefing to be done in an unconventional way. We don't know what it is. We don't know whose request it was. But at least, as I read it, there's no indication as to why this was done in this way.
I agree there's no indication. I don't think it matters, because it seems clear that this was an arrangement that was approved either explicitly or tacitly by defense counsel, the prosecutor, and the court. The court right. certainly had the authority to say, we're not going forward with it. But the court went forward knowing that it had not received briefs.
Right. But I don't think that necessarily is held against one party or the other. We don't know how it came about.
Well, but this is a case where the state has the burden. And I want to, Chief, you asked about why not just a remand. But the answer is, I'll get to that in a minute. You seem to be focusing on that there were three versions. Was he ordered to stop, informed to stop, or asked, or did he spontaneously stop? Those are the three that come out in testimony. And then the judge's findings are that he was asked to stop. To my mind, the first two, ordered and informed, there is no constitutional difference between the two. Both raise it from a field inquiry to an investigative detention. There is no such thing as being informed to stop constitutionally. That's an order from police officers, because we don't want people saying, wait, was that just informed? That's a stop. You're told to stop. I don't think asked is any different. So there were two possibilities the judge had to choose from.
You don't think there's a difference if they had said, would you stop?
I do. That I think is different.
Well, doesn't that go right to the heart of it, the nature of the kind of interaction? Or is it simply the fact that they uttered the word stop in whatever sentence was said, if a sentence was said at all?
So I think stop matters a great deal. Unlike Mr. Mason, I think all the other things are kind of in the ether. And I think telling someone to stop or asking them to stop, Justice LaVecchia, is perilous territory for a police officer if they want to be in field inquiry land.
And this is an area that our law is not crystal clear on.
I don't actually agree. So I go
facts
back.
Facts matter a great deal in this area.
Without a doubt. However, if I might, when we were arguing Rosario, I was trying to make the point that Ms. Rosario had been seized, had been stopped. And the question was when. Was it when the police blocked in her car? Was it when the flashlight shone on her? Or was it when the request for identification happened? And I think we all agreed that what we're trying to figure out
was the totality.
It was the totality. And when did the actions of police officers amount to an order to stop? And even in the dissent in Rosario, Justice Albin, even Justice Solomon's very nicely written dissent, talked about...
You're being recorded.
Not so nice.
Beautifully written, wrong answer, but beautifully written, talked about the fact that Ms. Rosario was stopped to begin with. And had she been moving and then stopped, the analysis would have been different. Well, Mr. Carter was moving and was told or asked to stop.
But when there's an... Excuse me, Justice Albin. When this point is left hanging between counsel at the very end of the hearing, Mr. Feldman, on behalf of the state, says you can obviously argue if you think they didn't have a right to even go up to him, or if they, and then stop, and then defense counsel says, I'm going to touch on that. I don't know what that means. Does that mean they didn't even have an opportunity, that he was going to consider they couldn't approach him and ask him any questions? I mean, obviously that flies in the face of field inquiry land. Or are we going to get into the nitty-gritty of that very fine line as to when an inquiry turns into a stop and someone no longer objectively, from an objectively reasonable perspective, would feel free to leave? And that's where words really matter.
I don't dispute at all that words really matter, and I think no one could dispute that this case could have been lawyered differently at every stage of the trial process. However, no one could suggest that what the trial prosecutor was inviting the defense attorney to raise was the idea that field inquiries were impermissible. There's no, that you can never do a field inquiry, right? You couldn't go up to him at all. Couldn't have meant you, even in the least, because there's no support in the jurisprudence
right.
for that anywhere.
But my point is the whole trajectory of the ending of this hearing and then into the briefs are all focused on the search of the knapsack.
But here's the thing. There was testimony about whether he was told to stop, and the judge made a finding. That finding is entitled to deference if it is supported by the record. And
the
even if there's contrary testimony,
to stop.
I'm sorry.
Wasn't the finding that he was asked to stop?
So here's my perspective on that, Justice Lavecchia.
Yes.
Being asked to stop is not a field inquiry unless the police are so hyper careful as to make sure the defendant, a reasonable person, not the defendant, but a reasonable person in the defendant's shoes, would know that he doesn't have to.
Haven't we addressed this? I mean, we have spoken to this. State versus Crawley.
Right.
Is this case, in fact, this case is a much worse scenario. In State versus Crawley, two police officers are in a car, they open up the window, and they say to the suspect, and I'm quoting, please stop, I need to speak with you. He runs. We said, our court said, the failure to stop constituted obstruction of justice.
This is a good time to tell him it's beautifully written.
Hated that opinion. Justice Patterson, I thought it was a terrible opinion. Yeah.
Not only that, we told a defendant who is told to stop, even if you think it was an unconstitutional stop, don't run, hold your ground, bring your claim to court. That's exactly what Carter has done. Carter stopped when he was asked to stop, and now he has brought his claim to court, precisely what we said he should do in Crawley. No?
That's right. So I want to just quickly...
Mr. Shalom, can I go back to Justice Lavecchia's question?
Of course.
How would you describe these two statements? Would you wrap up your argument in 2 minutes? You have 2 more minutes. One's an ask, one's a command.
Correct. So
words would help if that had been fleshed out at the hearing, no?
Right. I will try to wrap up my argument in 2 minutes under either of those circumstances.
But they're different.
But they are different. And so I think the one, but neither of them sound like, hey, are you willing to answer some questions, which is what we're talking about in field inquiry land. So I agree that they are different in degree, Chief Justice Ravner, but I don't think they're different in kind, and I think both get you into investigative detention rather than field inquiry.
Tell us what, with an eye toward a fair and efficient process for all parties, what should the notice of motion say?
Okay, so I remember sitting in Mr. Ducote's seat and losing in wit, and one of the things that I said to this court was I think you're creating a level of process that's unnecessary, because I think all the rule you're proposing is going to invite is Mr. Krikora or Mr. Russo or Perrone, someone to create a checklist form for a notice of motion. Because I think it becomes ineffective for a lawyer to not just check all the boxes. Yes, I'm checking the stop and the search and the fruits and the arrest, because why not? Because there's no harm in being over-inclusive, so then you get that nonsensical civil pleading where you get every affirmative defense in the world, even ones that have no plausible relation. I don't think it's going to make prosecutors better informed about what the case is. I think you're going to make people dot their I's and cross their T's but not convey more information.
I don't think it's so difficult. I'm challenging the stop and the search. That's going to cover it all. The problem in Witt is that he only mentioned the search. I mean, at least this particular notice, although, as I said, far from a model, seems to be all-inclusive.
So I want to say something. Before the issue of this, of the waiver came up, we got involved at the petition stage, which the ACLU almost never does, because the decision of the appellate division was so outrageous, because it shifted the burden to the defendant, because it made this nonsensical distinction between being informed to stop and ordered to stop. And we thought what it was going to do was give license to police to just write reports saying I informed him to stop right, when they sure meant he was ordered to stop. Though I think it does run into an interesting Crawley question, because if the person then runs, how can it be obstruction?
But here we not only have the stop, we have 4 police officers barreling out of a car with insignia police.
As I said, I thought it was exceptional enough to warrant extraordinary...
How fast were they barreling out of the car?
I missed that point.
The barreling.
Barreling is the same as being ordered to stop. It's obvious.
Let's get back to that civil answer for a minute.
But so I think on the facts, this case is very disturbing. But I think the scarier result for us is shifting the ethos of New Jersey away from a judiciary that values only sustaining those convictions free from constitutional error. And so in this case, if you think this record is simply not robust enough, remember that the state failed to make the robust record. It was their burden, and therefore it must fall. And so I think we want to make sure we can give all sorts of guidance for future pleadings, but let's not transform New Jersey into the sort of judiciary that simply relies on procedural default. I think it's contrary to Preciosi and our long lineage of jurisprudence. It's also contrary to Rule 1:1-2.
What is contrary to Preciosi? A requirement that the issues be flagged in a notice of motion?
No, not that, Justice
okay.
Garrison.
So that's
a rigid adherence to procedural rules over a fair adjudication of a case.
But I mean, if what we're talking about here, maybe there is a checklist, and that's just the way lawyers operate, and that's the way young lawyers are trained, and it's not the end of the world if someone is actually checking off something from a checklist.
I don't disagree, but I do want to point out what will happen there. Then you'll have the very skilled lawyers in the Office of the Public Defender who will be obedient to the rules and will do that. You'll get an occasional private attorney who will fail to and will wind up before you on an ineffective assistance of counsel motion, right? If it becomes so we have to just figure out what value it adds before we erect a procedural roadblock.
But I think this case illustrates some value it would have added, and you know, with due respect to whoever drafted the notice of motion, it could be read a number of different ways.
The notice of motion is terrible. The litigation in this case is terrible. I'm not going to mince words. I think it was very poorly done. However, I don't think there was unfair surprise. And when you have a prosecutor stand up and say, this issue is before us. And my final point, if we want to become folks who become rigid about waiver, then the state waived its ability to argue waiver by failing to argue it at the appellate division, to Justice Albin's point. They didn't raise this idea. This was brought up sua sponte by the appellate division, in fact, as happened in Preciosi. So Justice Stein's opinion in Preciosi was saying, in effect, to the appellate division, that's not how we do things here. And I think a similar message is important here. We need a merits adjudication. There's a factual finding by the judge that is supported by the record, even if it could have been made differently, even if it could have been lawyered better or decided better. There's a factual finding by the judge that's entitled to deference. His legal conclusion is not entitled to deference, and his legal conclusion is plainly contrary to well-established New Jersey law.
Thank
unless
you.
There are any further questions. And sorry, I didn't wrap up in 2 minutes.
I didn't order or request you to, Mr. Ducote.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Defendant waived his right to challenge Detective Johnson's initial approach of him when he failed to raise the issue before the motion judge ruled on the motion to suppress. Everything, from the notice of motion to the bulk of his cross to the post-hearing brief and oral argument and even an admission at sentencing, made it clear that defendant was challenging only the search of the knapsack at police headquarters, not the initial stop. And even when it was suggested to him by the prosecutor that he might want to raise the issue, he affirmatively chose not to, probably because 30 lines of Detective Johnson's credible testimony on cross made it crystal clear that he didn't say anything before defendant discarded the drugs. If this court meant what it said in Witt, that it would be unfair and contrary to established rules to decide the lawfulness of this stop when the state was deprived the opportunity to fully develop the record, and more importantly, the trial court was denied the chance to make an informed and precise ruling on the issue, then the outcome here is clear. Defendant waived this issue, and this court shouldn't consider it. The only difference between this case and Witt is that there was another issue to address in Witt, namely automobile exception. Defendant abandoned the only issue he waived in the trial court, and so that ends the matter. Now, had the issue been properly raised, the state would have more fully developed the record. I lay out some of those questions in my brief. I'm not going to repeat them here, but I will say that based on what we do have, if this court elects to not decide this matter on the waiver issue, even on what we do have, we have Detective Johnson's credible testimony clarifying what he said on direct, that while he said yes to a leading question, did he inform him to stop, and later mentions the word told him to stop, he makes it clear in 30 lines of cross-examination that that's not what happened. He makes it clear that he did not tell the defendant to stop, that the defendant stopped on his own, and that the defendant was the one who spoke first. And this is confirmed by the, or corroborated, rather, by the police report, which the judge considered as part of his decision. Police presence in a public place alone does not cause a reasonable, innocent person to believe he is not free to leave. Even below, in the trial court, defense counsel called this a conversation and started his argument with assuming everything about the stop was fine and beginning with the arrest. That's where he was making the issue. And if the issue really was field inquiry versus reasonable articulable suspicion to stop, where's all the case law in the brief from this court and the appellate division about those issues? Where's all the argument from defense counsel about why the trial court should credit the direct testimony and not the more extensive cross-examination? Where is all of that? That's what you would have seen in this record had this issue been properly raised. So the question is what it has always been, and that is, under an objective view of the totality of the circumstances, would a reasonable, innocent person feel free to walk away? And even on this limited record, and we could know a whole lot more, and some of the questions from this court have made that clear. But this occurred in a public place near defendant's home in the middle of the afternoon. Police were in an unmarked vehicle 125 feet away. There were plainclothes officers that had badges on them. And defendant was already walking away, which in my opinion supports the idea that his freedom of movement was not so restricted that he felt that he could not move at all. There was no show of authority by word or deed by any of these officers. To briefly comment on the barreling, use of the word barreling, that's not in the record. There's a number of things not in the record that appear in my colleague's briefs, and I point that out in my brief as well. But the most we know is that Detective Johnson and maybe one other officer started walking towards defendant. We don't know the position of the other two officers. They could have been in the car. They could have been outside the car. That and a host of other things we don't know about this record. So I'd like to address a couple things I heard earlier. First, about not raising the issue in the appellate division. That is correct. We did not raise the issue in the appellate division, but there's three responses to that. First, that's exactly what happened in Witt. There's no indication the state ever raised that issue in Witt. And contrary to something I heard earlier, on page 416 of that opinion, this court does discuss the trial court's finding in Witt that the officer had a right to conduct that motor vehicle stop. So there was something in the record there. The second thing is the rules impose an obligation on an appellant in the appellate division to point out that an issue was not raised below. As the appellate court pointed out in this case, that rule was not followed. So that rule is designed to put respondents and courts on notice that issues are being raised for the first time. And third, the point, waiver is not a game of gotcha. The point is not, oh, well, we're not going to raise it, and we'll see if you forget to not point out that we didn't raise it. The point is, when you don't raise the issue below, you deprive reviewing courts of a record. So whether we point it out or not, a lousy record was still made in a case where the issue wasn't raised below.
Except your failure, your office's failure to raise this before the appellate division indicates that apparently you didn't think waiver was an issue. You went right to the merits, argued the merits. You never argued that somehow the record was deficient, was inadequate for the appellate division. None of those arguments were made. Am I correct?
Correct. It wasn't raised in the appellate division.
You went right to the merits. It was only after the appellate division said, oh, we think it was waived, that your office for the first time said, this is a pretty good argument.
But the appellate division pointed out that we were deprived of the notice required under the rule that the issue hadn't been raised below. I'm not saying that, you know, in a perfect world we wouldn't have raised that, but we didn't.
Why didn't your office follow 357 and file your statement of facts in brief in the first place? Do you have an explanation?
Answer that. All I can say is that the rules are not, unfortunately, like many rules, they're not always followed to the letter in terms of procedure. A lot of judges do elect to just have the hearing and then allow the parties to brief it after. And I just want to make one response to this notion of, that there's rigid formalism, and if it's not raised in the notice of motion, it's waived. That is not our position. If this issue had been raised, even in the post-hearing brief, I would not be taking the position that it's waived. I think it's fair, and I think it's fundamentally appropriate to look at the waiver question. You look at the entire proceedings before the trial court.
The post-hearing brief did have a sentence saying this stop was without probable cause, correct?
I don't recall reading that.
I quoted from it. I think it's in your appendix. It's in the Attorney General's appendix. It's on A13. And it says, the detective, this is the statement of facts by the defense attorney. The detective testified that the defendant was not doing anything suspicious and there was no probable cause to stop him.
And that's a correct recitation of the testimony. That wasn't an argument that there was no reason to stop.
And there was no problem. So are you conceding there was no probable cause to stop him?
Yeah, I'll concede that. There was no probable cause to stop him. There was no reason more articulable suspicion to stop him. This was a field inquiry, plain and simple. That's our position.
And for that reason, the sentence that Justice Alban is referring to doesn't go to the issue that is now being raised.
Right, and it doesn't go to the issues that were raised then either. No one ever said that we had probable cause to stop this individual.
Would you concede that that the record here is not as sparse a record as was the record in Witt on the issue that's being talked about? I mean, there's something...
I mean, without looking at that, I mean, no, there's something here. I mean, there's something here to take and run with, and that's why my secondary position is there is enough if you look at the totality of the credible testimony. But the fact of the matter is, had the issue been raised, there would be a better record, and we would have a precise finding by the trial court on this issue. I mean, it was pointed out by a number of members of this court that the officer's testimony was not identical on cross and direct. The judge would have had to make a specific finding which one of those was credible and more believable. Arguably, and that would have driven the analysis.
Arguably, the judge rejected what was said on cross. Whether asked is a reference to told or stopped or informed is a debatable question, but it doesn't seem that the judge endorsed the third variation that came forward.
The judge didn't make a finding at all, other than the officer's testimony was credible.
The judge said at page 9, line 19, defendant walked away, the officers identified themselves and asked him to stop.
But as was pointed out before, the fact that the judge mentions it, that doesn't make it a finding. His findings come later on the disputed questions. Which have to do with the inventory. I don't see that to be a finding.
What else?
And if the finding is asked, there's no support in the record ask. He was either informed or nothing was said at all.
He's going through the facts, his finding of facts. Look, would you concede that it's just not unusual for a witness, a police officer, or a defense witness to try to vary the testimony to get out of something that he or she said that was damning on direct? That happens all the time. And then the judge makes a finding whether or not to accept the explanation on cross-examination or to hold the person to what he or she said on direct. And that appears to be precisely what the judge did in making the
findings. I disagree that the detective was trying to get out of anything. Certainly his cross was corroborated by his police report. So unless he was thinking of this moment, you know, a year before when he was writing his police report, I just don't endorse what you just said.
If the court doesn't accept your waiver argument and instead goes to the merits, how have you carried your burden?
I think we've carried our burden because if you look at the totality of the circumstances of this encounter, a reasonable person in Asmar Carter's position would have felt free to leave. He would not have felt that he was stopped. And that's based on what we do know that the officer testified on cross, again, and was found credible by the court, that nothing was said. That he disregarded, or not disregarded, but he disputed the idea that that's how he testified to on direct, and he made crystal clear on cross exactly what he meant. And that was explored at length by defense counsel on cross, which probably explains why he didn't raise the issue.
Take that arrow out of the quiver here. Assume that there is a finding, and I know you don't, but accept that. How do you meet your burden?
Well, if the finding is that he asked him to stop, And everything else we know about this stop is that he was free to move about because we knew he was walking away initially. At most, we have one or two officers approaching him. Again, we don't know where the other two are. We don't know what tone it was said. Nothing about this indicates that he was somehow seized and not free to leave.
Isn't that your burden to demonstrate where those officers were, if we're going to go straight to the merits? Sorry.
If the issue had been raised, we would have asked those questions. But that's why it's fundamentally unfair to now hold us to... Your question, Chief, that's the whole point of
the question. If we get to the merits and don't accept waiver, how do you prevail? That's because you've invited us to do so as your second fallback position, and that's what I was probing.
Well, I mean, it's a lot harder of a case, to be sure, but certainly, you know, it's very hard to answer that question because if the issue isn't raised below, and we don't have an opportunity to ask those important questions.
But you did.
Then,
you did.
If you're assuming that, then...
There is testimony, your direct testimony, that was elicited by the prosecutor. He said, I informed him to stop, and I didn't have to run, okay, because he stopped. And then we went up to him. And I either had my police tag or my police vest on. So he was there. That's a Crawley type of situation. And there were either two or four police officers approaching him. Are you suggesting that a person would feel free to walk away as the officer informs him to stop and he's coming at him? When we have said in Crawley, if you keep on walking or running, you're guilty of obstruction?
Well, Crawley begins with an order to stop, which is not what we have here.
It's please stop. Please stop, I need to speak with you. That's Crawley. That's all they said. Please roll down the window. That's all that was said. Please stop, I need to speak with you.
Did you say at the beginning of the argument, I thought you said, and maybe I don't recall the record as well, that before the police officer said or did anything, he discarded the package?
That was the testimony of Detective Johnson on cross-examination, yes.
Was there any testimony that contradicted that?
On direct, he was asked the leading question, did you inform him to stop?
Okay,
and but he said yes, but other than that, no.
Was he ever asked, when did he discard the package in that testimony? In the direct. Before or after you told him to stop?
It was after.
All right, I missed that. Is there any testimony to contradict his statement on cross that he discarded the package before anything else happened?
No, nothing that came after that cross.
Was there any finding by the court with respect to that?
No. And I submit,
go ahead.
I would submit that would be the critical finding
there. If the court, okay, never mind. I'm done.
And the reason why, and I, just to point out that I don't take a hard-line position about, you know, everything has to be in the notice of motion or it's waived forever. Obviously, things can come up at the hearing that the parties weren't anticipating. But at least before the judge rules, then the state would have an opportunity to say, oh, I didn't know this was an issue. Before this hearing is complete, I want to call another officer. I want to ask this officer some more questions now that we know the meets and bounds of the issues.
But the one issue you have with regard to that is that the comment by the prosecutor at the end of the hearing, when the evidence is all in, is not, wait a minute, let me find out if they're going to raise this issue with the stop, in which case I'm going to bring my officer back. It's instead, you're free to raise this in your brief.
Right. Well, what's important about that is he didn't. So the prosecutor...
No, I understand that, but it does not suggest that if that prosecutor had been told at that moment... Yeah, both are before the court. We plan to argue both. That the prosecutor would have then brought back an officer or put out a different.
They could have. They certainly would have asked some more questions about the tone. Where were these other two officers? Tell me more about the intersection. When you have a motion to suppress and you're talking about where the defendant is vis-a-vis, you know, whether he can move around. You know, you want to get questions out about. You know, is this an open area? Is it somewhat confined? You know, was his back up against the wall? You'd want to know all that.
There was detailed questioning about this. They said, we watched him from 5 to 10 minutes from our car. We drove the car towards him within 25 feet. In court, they were measuring the distance between the car and the defendant. They were going into great detail about the stop and about the approach.
But what matters is, whether defendant could have walked away. We don't know if he could have. I mean, I don't want to go beyond the record, but if you look at this intersection, it's double wide sidewalks on all four corners. Three of the four corners have parking lots.
It's not
it's
whether
wide
he
open.
It's
had
not,
that had we known the issue, we would have got that out.
No, it's not whether he could have. It's whether or not an objectively reasonable person, given all these circumstances, being informed to stop, two police officers with insignia of their police officers approaching him, whether an objectively reasonable person would think he could start walking away.
But the geography of the area certainly matters. In Caldwell, the officers cornered defendant inside a building, nowhere to go. I mean, so the surroundings of the defendant are relevant. You know, if this is in an open public area, like a shopping mall, then he'd be more likely to feel free to walk away as opposed to if he was chased down an alley, you know, into a corner. The difference between those two things is clear, and those are the kind of questions you get at a motion to suppress when the issue of is this a field inquiry, is this a stop, is it properly raised? That's the kind of record you would have.
You're an experienced advocate for the state. Tell us, what should the notice of motion look like? And perhaps the AG can address
that. I think the notice of motion should be more specific in the sense of when you have several parts of a stop, like say you have a motor vehicle stop and an automobile search of it, and then you have a subsequent warrant, you know, you want to identify which of those areas you're challenging. I don't think it's enough to say, you know, I'm challenging all constitutional procedures utilized by the, that tells me nothing. As a prosecutor, that tells me absolutely nothing about what the defendant plans on challenging. So I think at least to set the stage, if you will, maybe not forevermore, but certainly at the outset, to point out what aspects of the encounter you're challenging, and ideally maybe those that you're not, you know, by default, to simply take certain things off the table.
Well, the latter would be beyond a notice of motion. Notice of motion,
right.
You're saying what you're moving on. It could be almost infinite what you're not moving on.
And I would agree with my colleagues that if you put some kind of checklist in place, then you're going to get situations where they just check every box. And then, you know, it'll say at the bottom, we agree to, you know, we reserve our right to amend accordingly later. I mean, you're not going to, I don't think that's going to move the ball in the direction this court wants it to go. That's why I think
Better than not knowing if the stop is being challenged?
It'll be better if it's properly utilized and not just a kitchen sink approach every time, which for fear of ineffective assistance of counsel claims, I imagine even decent attorneys are going to check every conceivable box. So, but that's why I don't want to be wed too much to the notice of motion. My position is not they waived it when they filed the notice of motion. My position is it was waived because when the judge was called upon to rule, everything the defense attorney had done at that point was limited to the inventory search of the knapsack.
And when you point to that, there was a little bit of oral argument before the court rendered its decision. And defense counsel talks about what's undisputed. And they very quickly go over that he was arrested, and this is all about the search that was conducted
Correct.
Thereafter.
I think in almost every opinion you see, even opinions from this court, if you're talking about a motion to suppress, you don't usually just jump right into the disputed issue. You do give a little background, even if it's not, facts are not disputed. So.
I'm sorry.
Well, the counsel says that the undisputed facts are the defendant was arrested on April 7, 2015 by the police. At that time, he was cuffed, he was searched, and the bag that he was carrying, the knapsack that he was carrying, was secured by police. Everything else that runs from there is all about the inventory search of the of that knapsack.
Yeah. Correct. And the last thing I said was more about the judge's oral findings and not to, you know, that wasn't a precise finding that I think an appellate court would want in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, whether he ordered somebody to stop or said nothing at all. Obviously, the whole case would have turned on that issue had it been properly been raised.
If you're not taking issue with the notice of motion, then your initial burden of presenting the facts would be what it is. You would know that you would have to develop the record on all the potential mm-hmm. issues, the stop and the search, including the inventory search, correct?
Right, but under the rule, there's supposed to be briefs before the hearing.
But you didn't do that, so you can't argue about that. You were responsible for filing the first brief. You didn't do that. And you have told us that you aren't thrown off by the notice. So at least you can't be complaining about the record that you developed since you had the burden of developing the record.
But then this court didn't mean what it said in Witt when it said defendant had to identify the issues. The state is not required to. Then you're talking about shadow issues that aren't properly raised that we have to address.
Look, I didn't say it. You said that the notice here is not the issue for you. In Witt, apparently.
Not the only issue. I just wanted to make
that. I take it mean that you're not relying exclusively
right.
on the
notice. I'm not saying, well, you didn't raise it in a notice and everything else that happened
right.
after that was
you're
irrelevant.
Talking about the
obviously,
totality.
It could have been raised. The point is it could have been raised, by my count, at least 4 or 5 times before the trial judge ruled.
Right.
I mean, in the notice of motion, you know, in a pre-hearing brief, nobody filed pre-hearing briefs, at the hearing, post-hearing brief, post-hearing argument, five opportunities. So, you know, in a waiver in this case, it's not as simple as just looking at one point of the
Do you agree, Mr. Ducote, that the appellate division went too far in suggesting that defendant has a burden?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course. That's,
let's just be clear about that.
I don't say ridiculous a lot from here, but that, I mean, that's just so contrary to everything we know. Yeah. But what's important about that is the trial court didn't hold the defendant to that burden. Clearly, the trial court applied the correct burden. This court granted review of the appellate division's judgment. The appellate division's opinion was unpublished. I don't fear what my friends on the other side fear as, you know, this deluge of now everyone's going to start putting the burden on defendant. I haven't seen that. I don't expect it, and I would concede that issue every time.
Thank you.
Other questions? Anything else you'd like to add?
No, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lockwood-Leo.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I first would like to address some of the key facts in this issue, in this case, and why they relate to waiver. First, there has been a few questions regarding why there was a post-hearing brief. And the first indication of that in this record is on AA2. In the notice of motion, defense counsel also mentions that he will be relying on a post-hearing brief. So that's first. And the second, in that notice, the issue for defense counsel was the inventory search. So based on his framing of the notice of motion, I would argue that that was only contesting the search. He said, based on the unconstitutional procedures utilized and searches conducted by the state by searching defendant and his property in this matter. So again, I would argue that that was only related to the search. Now, if we look at exactly what happened in this record and why it relates to waiver, at the suppression hearing, Detective Johnson very clearly and repeatedly clarified his testimony 9 times. I counted in the record 9 times he clarified that he didn't actually say anything before the defendant volunteered marijuana. Under our case law, that is not a search or seizure, not a stop or seizure by the police. Then, after the detective stepped down from the witness stand, at that point, defense counsel again asked for an opportunity to submit a post-hearing brief on an issue of search incident to arrest. So again, the prosecutor was unaware of the need to defend that, and of course there is that conversation where the prosecutor does invite defense counsel to argue the initial counter, but defense counsel affirmatively chooses not to do so. Instead, in his post-hearing brief before the trial court, the defense counsel phrases the initial police encounter, which is the only issue before this court, in friendly terms, stating Detective Johnson started a conversation with the defendant. Again, under our case law, that is not a stop or seizure by the police. And then at oral argument, counsel did not even mention the initial counter with police, but instead began his recitation of the undisputed facts with defendant was arrested. Once again, the state at that point was deprived of the simple opportunity to just say to the judge, listen, I guess they're challenging the stop in this case, or not stop, the initial encounter with the police at this in this case, but as you will recall, Detective Johnson was very clear on cross-examination that he never actually said anything, and under our case law, that is in the stop procedure.
Ms. Bonfiglio, you're here as a friend of the court today. Yes. What steps can and should we take to avoid this very issue of being litigated at the Supreme Court level and clarify it in a way that neither side feels that there's a gotcha effort at stake? How do we avoid this?
So I think Rule 3:5-7 is very informative, because in subsection C, a defendant wouldn't even get a testimonial hearing unless he alleges material facts in dispute. So going forward, I think that there does need to be stricter compliance with the rule. If it is a warrantless search, the prosecutor, well, of course, there's going to have to be a notice of motion first, and defense counsel, as best as he can at that point, should try to alert the prosecutor as to what he is exactly challenging, and that way the prosecutor can attempt to meet his burden. I think it is important to have briefs pre-hearing, and that way the trial court can consciously rule on the issues. So that's part of the issues in this case.
And then we would know what was contested, because the whole purpose of 357 is for the state to indicate to both the court and the defendant its facts. And then the defense is supposed to say what facts it's contesting. It may not be contesting the facts.
Exactly.
But the initial burden in warrantless searches is on the state.
It is. And I think the problem, again, in this situation is the notice of motion, and maybe that was the procedure used in Essex County, is that defense counsel specifically said he would be relying on a post-hearing brief. So I think that's just part of the problem. Going forward, there definitely needs to be some kind of compliance with the rule. And, of course, defense attorneys may not be able to predict every issue, but there needs to be some kind of notice to the state. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Is Detective Johnson's testimony initially, based on the prosecutor's leading testimony, was very inconsistent with his police report. Now, his police report was written probably right after the incident, and the suppression hearing was 1 year and 4 months afterwards. So because it wasn't on anybody's radar at that point, to be exactly precise on a critical point, there was this initial inconsistent testimony. But again, Detective Johnson was very clear on cross-examination, and at that point...
You're arguing the facts as though we're like the initial motion judge here.
I'm not, and
I mean,
I'm sorry, the
judge went through his recitation of the facts. May not like them. You may say he should have accepted the cross, he should have accepted the police report, but the judge said what he said.
But again, the important fact is that the trial court has to be alert to the basic issues.
He heard the testimony, he heard the direct, he heard the cross, and he had the police report, and then he made his findings.
But he didn't hear anything from the defense counsel stating, "Judge, this is an unconstitutional stop, and here's why." He didn't hear any law on stops, on field inquiries, on anything, and he never related it to this case. And again, even defense counsel in his brief said Detective Johnson started a conversation. So consideration of the trial court's imprecise and flatly contradictory findings shows exactly why wit should be applied here.
There's nothing, tell me if I'm wrong about this, there's nothing relating to the standard that distinguishes a field inquiry from a stop.
There's no, the
court isn't making any of those, the words are not there that you would expect if there were a ruling on that.
Exactly. They're not there in the briefs or at oral argument. And again, defense counsel started his recitation of the facts at oral argument with defendant was arrested. So any fact finding by the judge on say that he was asked to stop, it's not supported by the record.
And yet none of this is raised. This is such a big issue before us. But when the state was appealed, when this was appealed to the appellate division, everyone goes right to the merits. No one's raising any of the issues that you're raising right now. Everyone thought that the record was perfectly fine on which to make that decision, correct? By the state's brief and the defense brief.
That is correct, Your Honor, but in the appellate division, defendant did not alert the court or the prosecutor to say this issue was not raised below. Instead,
the state could have done that. The state could have said this issue wasn't raised. That's what the state would do if it thought it wasn't raised. The first thing it would say is to the appellate division, this was waived. Why are we even deciding this? You didn't do that. The state didn't do that.
The state could have, but the merits in this case, in my opinion, are so clear that maybe they just went to the merits. But in any event, they would have had to address the merits because, say, the appellate division didn't agree with the waiver argument. They still would have had to address the merits. And the merits in this case are so clear because the detective clarified his testimony 9 times. And, again, his testimony was consistent with his report.
Are the merits really that clear? If a judge were to find that 4 officers approached an individual with their badges displayed and told the person to stop, is that a field inquiry?
I would say no, but I would also say that, those facts were not elicited before the motion court. We don't even know if we have to assume that there were 4 officers because the only testimony in the record is that Detective Johnson said me and the other detective decided to conduct the field interview. So right. We would have to assume that it was 4 officers. We would have to assume that they told defendant to stop.
So again, if we're looking just at the merits, it's your burden to dispel this potentially problematic scenario, no?
Absolutely, but again, prosecutor was unfairly deprived of that chance to clear up the
record.
Well,
how was he? I'm looking at page 11. This is direct. And were all 4 of you dressed the same way? Correct. Did you identify yourselves at any point as police? Correct. And then did you inform him to stop? I mean, the clear suggestion is that all 4 were out and approaching. Like, why would the prosecutor be asking how are they addressed and whether or not they identified themselves as police? And he's talking about 4. He's not suggesting 2 were in the car. That's the testimony that was elicited by the prosecutor on direct.
Well, that could very well be background information. I mean, the prosecutor isn't going to start the suppression hearing with, so what did you start searching the defendant? You need background information. And part of the defendant's argument is that this was a pretext. So a lot of those facts are very relevant.
Can I take you back to just,
sure.
You had earlier said greater compliance with 357 is an important piece. If it's complied with, is there any attention, that extra attention needs to be paid to the notice of motion, or will 357 cure any problems going forward?
I believe, will cover, like, compliance with 357 will cover a lot of this, but I think, again, because it is the state's burden with a warrantless search, the state has to be on some kind of notice on exactly what is at issue. So in the notice, if they could at least just say, we are challenging the stop, we are challenging the search, we're challenging both, I think that would solve a lot of these issues that we have here today.
Thank you. Anything you wanted to add? I thought you were about to sum up.
Very briefly, the 3 dangers in our waiver rules are that is exactly what happens in this case. First, the state is now unfairly deprived. I'm sorry. The state is now constrained to an abbreviated factual record on something it was led to believe was a non-issue while being unfairly deprived of the opportunity to clear up the record in the first place. Second, the motion judge did not have the opportunity to rule on the matter in a informed and precise manner. And third, reviewing courts, including this court, is left with an abbreviated factual record on a critical point that should have been raised below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mason.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to touch on 3 brief points. The first one, Justice Solomon's question before about the order in which things happened in this case, at least according to Detective Johnson's testimony. On his direct examination from pages 12 to 13 on the first motion transcript and then 21 to 23, he talks about how he told Mr. Carter to stop, how he stopped when we told him, which I would note is actually just his own testimony that was not a leading question. And then it was only at that point that, according to Mr. Johnson, Mr. Carter threw marijuana on the ground. So it was a direct result. So under State versus Tucker, if this court were to find an unlawful stop, that would need to be suppressed. The second issue, as to Justice LaVecchia's questioning before about informing to stop, asking to stop. In this case, I think the focus really just needs to be on the fact that he said stop. Anytime that an officer says stop, I think that that would create a natural presumption for somebody that they're not free to ignore it. And I think that would be even true even if they were to ask. And I would point the court toward U.S. versus Smith, which is 594 F3D 530. It's a Sixth Circuit case. In that case, the trial court's finding was that the defendant was asked to stop.
What about, and was stopped. Would you mind stopping for a few minutes and speaking with us? I mean, are you really saying the word stop is dispositive?
I think stop is very important, but we still need to look at the totality of the circumstances.
Right. But if you were asked to stop in the manner, you know, that manner or some similarly, that's not a problem, is it?
In some cases, that might be true. I think in this case, it would still be different because you still have all of the other displays of authority. If you were to walk up to a person, if Detective Johnson had just walked up to Mr. Carter on his own and said, would you mind stopping so you could answer a few questions, I think we might be talking about a different result. But in a case like this, we have...
State versus Maryland suggest that?
Yeah. In a case like that where... It really is voluntary and formal. It wouldn't be offensive if a random person had come up and said that to you. It's a normal conversation.
No. Doesn't Maryland also suggest that officers, depending on the way in which they ask the question or approach the individual, context matters?
Context does matter, Your Honor. And in this case, the context would include there being the multiple officers, badges, everything like that. I don't know how an officer in this situation could say stop in really any context after having approached in that manner where a reasonable person would feel free to leave. And I think Smith in this court's prior cases.
What was the page citation on that case you just mentioned?
So the actual pin site for that is...
You said 594 F3rd what?
530 for the last four. And it's 2010 from the Sixth Circuit.
Thank you.
And then the last issue, I just want to touch on waiver one more time. I don't know really how... The state could be arguing waiver in this case, at least under wit, or at least say that they would have developed the record differently. When you actually have the prosecutor saying that, I think the appellate prosecutors might have a different position if, you know, maybe they would have litigated the case differently, but that's not what the state said below. And even now, with the benefit of hindsight, they have not identified anything that would have changed the outcome in this case if their notice had been provided, and I would submit even on a remand at this point. Instead, I think that this really is a dramatic departure, at least what they're proposing, on both fronts, both for the stop and for the waiver, and that it would really run contrary to this court's prior holdings. So for those reasons, we would respectfully request that this court affirm its prior holdings and reverse Mr. Carter's conviction.
I have just one question.
Yes, Your Honor.
On cross-examination, did the detective say that he discarded the marijuana before the officers said anything?
I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor.
To put it direct, I think their position was, I think the AG said 9 times on cross-examination.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that count works out for it, but on pages 20 to 21, that is cross-examination on the first motion transcript, I don't think the detective's testimony is clear on that at all. I think that that can be read both as saying that he didn't say anything after initially saying telling Mr. Carter to stop. The state is obviously arguing a different position and saying that he never said anything at all. That's the type of factual inconsistency or issue that we ask trial courts to resolve at the time and that the trial court did resolve with sufficient evidence of the record in this case. Unless there are any other questions, respectfully request. Thank you.
Thank you to counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take this under advisement. Next is in the matter.